Back together again, you and I, in a midweek Wednesday, October 26th, the 2022 edition of Connecticut Today. We talked about some new poll numbers pointing toward an apparent desire by Connecticut residents for some period of early voting in the next few years. Quinnipiac University International Business Professor Dr. Mohamed Elahi discussed the significance of Britain's new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and we also welcomed a call from Republican Lieutenant Gubernatorial candidate Laura Devlin.
There is a real-world example now, because there always is, right? And I never talk to you folks on this show just like half-arsed, if you know what I mean. Nothing is done for effect here. And I've had, thank God I don't have these people that direct me here at Connoisseur, but I've encountered a few people in the past here in the business of, you know, talk radio and radio in general, and I could literally count them on one hand. I mean, there's less than five. Who, with all good intentions, have said, yeah, well, just say that. It'll shake up the phones. No, 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 no. I don't do that because that's not what I like to do. And you folks would sniff out phoniness. But I set out a warning for you probably a couple of months ago, and now it's coming to fruition with a real-world example. Now, let's step back. What did I say is going to happen after the turn of the of Election Day, and now less than 2 weeks, a week and 6 days, and then we get into the end of the year, and everybody's exhausted, everybody takes a breath, and then we turn the calendar, and the long term or the long session of the General Assembly takes place. Now, that's usually, remember now, we'll be the literati in Hartford. We'll be heading into the long session, and it's an odd year. So the way the majority works in Hartford is the uber contentious stuff is done in the odd years. Fee increases, tax increases, voting regulations, things that they would never bring up in the even years and then have to answer for in the following November, that never gets done. And that's been going on for years and years and years and years. I mean, there's no debate. I mean, both sides admit it. I've talked to both sides. And they say, yeah, even years, everybody is, you know, my relatives, my tribe is known to say in the even years, everything's a nice and nice, nice and nice. And then in the odd years, bend over. Hey, it's time for that annual exam. What am I connecting this to? Very simple. And this from that News 8 poll that has been released in segments throughout the first few days of this week. And this is a summary of that in the Connecticut News Junkie. More than half of Connecticut voters plan to support a constitutional amendment to allow the state to adopt an early voting law. That's according to that new WTNH survey. So they polled 1,000 likely voters between October 19th and the 21st. It was done by Emerson College for News 8 and The Hill, and it found 52% of voters plan to vote yes on the early balloting question, 35% plan to vote no, 13% say they hadn't made up their minds. But the way I like to look at, you know, the unpredictable vote, the not made up my mind category, split it down the middle, because that's generally what happens. So if you split that, say, 6 or 7% say no, that's still going to shake out to about a 58 to 42 yes. Now, what will that do? That will give permission for the General Assembly. It'll give them the keys to the car, as I like to say. It'll give them permission to take a look and go into, you know, to turn the key on, unlock the door to the state constitution. It's a very hallowed document. You're not supposed to blank around with it. Thankfully, we still don't, although we do run ends around on it. But the people are supposed to allow you to do that. So you may say, well, what's the big problem with that, Paul? Right? I mean, geez, it's only it's early voting and everything. And I mean, people say, well, maybe it's a good couple of days, 2-3 days. And I, in principle, I've got no problem with that. I honestly don't. If election day's on a Tuesday and you want to start early voting, I don't know, the previous week, the previous Wednesday, okay, I've got you, that's fine. Some people are elderly, they can't stand in lines, they can't apply for, or they have pride. A lot of people have pride, right? They don't want to, you get an absentee ballot, even though they might qualify for one because of infirmity or something. They don't want to do that. A lot of older people have pride, but by the same token, they've got their limitations. We all know that. We all feel it as we get older, right? So what's my problem here? Well, I'll tell you what my problem is. I'll sum it up in one word. Pennsylvania. What am I talking about? Well, I didn't watch too much of it last night, but there was a debate last night between the Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who's a Democrat, and he's running for the U.S. Senate seat, and the celebrity doctor, the Republican Dr. Oz, okay? Fetterman has been in Pennsylvania politics for a good few years, lieutenant governor, before that mayor of a small town that was a real, drug and crime haven, whatever. Okay, Dr. Oz, pretty much a carpetbagger, but smart guy, cardiac surgeon. So he's no dummy. I mean, carpetbagging has happened all across the political spectrum, Two words, Bobby Kennedy. Two more words, Hillary Clinton. So, both sides carpetbag. Let's get that right out of the shoe. What do I mean by Pennsylvania? Well, we've talked about this. In fact, we did a good hour and change on this a couple of weeks ago. Fetterman suffered a stroke. There's no crime in that. There's no crime in that. Stroke runs on my mother's side of the family. Now, it tends to happen on my mom's side of the family later in years. My mom, my grandmother, my aunt and uncle, they all had their strokes in their mid to late 80s. So hopefully I've got a few years left, God willing. But what do I mean by Pennsylvania? Well, if you read the reviews of John Fetterman's performance last night, or lack thereof, it wasn't good. Now, again, he had a stroke. Stroke victims, people who have strokes, they take a while to recover. When your brain loses oxygen and or blood flow for any appreciative amount of time, there's damage. And the brain takes a while to figure out, well, that road's closed now. I can't recognize speech the way I used to, or summarize and enunciate my thoughts the way I used to. Now I've got to figure out an end around to this. And it can happen. But the bottom line is, Pennsylvania has been voting for 50 days. And I saw this and I said, that sounds like a long time. Well, I went on the National Conference of State Legislatures website, ncsl.org/research. Great reference. I use this a lot. And I looked at, I found the chart where they specify early voting options by each state. So I scroll down, scroll. Oh, look, we finally get to Pennsylvania. And it says in the column, early voting begins in Pennsylvania 50 days before the election. That's in-person absentee early voting. Now, do you want that here in Connecticut? Do you want that? Now, I have no concrete information. I have zero concrete information that the folks in Hartford are going to look for 50 days or 40 days. But let me ask you this. And the phones are open if you want to chime in on this at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Do you not think, and this could be on the Republican side too, I'm not saying this is completely partisan one side or another, but in the case of Pennsylvania now, where they have 50 days before the election of in-person absentee ballot voting, is that fair to the people of the entire state of Pennsylvania, when some folks, perhaps knowing that John Fetterman suffered a stroke, went ahead and voted for him early? You see what I'm driving at here? I'm okay with a week of early voting, maybe two, but 50 days, 50. And you have a, now, prime example that I'm sure there were hundreds of thousands of people in Pennsylvania who already voted for John Fetterman. Now, a bunch of them might not care. You might have a scenario of people saying, well, I'll vote for a, and I don't mean this in a bad way for Mr. Fetterman, but Lieutenant Governor Fetterman, they might say, well, I'll take a Democratic stroke victim over a Republican any day. Okay, I get that. But you see what I'm driving at here. Be careful what the General Assembly may do, because somebody in Hartford, I don't know who it is, somebody is going to insanely, without a doubt, trust me on this, folks, somebody is going to insanely say Connecticut needs a month of early voting. They're going to say it. They are going to say it. They are going to say it. Now, what's the big deal in that if people know who they're going to vote for? And I'm telling you, all you need to know or to look at, if you're a little tentative about early voting beyond a week or so, because it's coming to Connecticut, folks. Trust me, if this poll is accurate from News 8 and The Hill and Emerson, most people, a majority of the state, are going to hand the keys to, to the General Assembly, which might be like giving a, you know, a drunk sailor an American Express black card on shore leave. Now, don't do anything naughty with it. Nah, us? No. And they could install, you know, with the Democratic majorities there, although I think you may need a three-quarter vote, I'm not sure. You know, they could press for a month of early voting. Now, I'm not saying they will. A week sounds good, maybe 3 or 4 days. It's not that big of a state. But be careful. Just look at Pennsylvania. John Fetterman, God bless him. I hope we don't get strokes. It's a horrible thing. But there are people, even Democrats now, watched that thing last night and went, oh, boy. But then again, people have been voting there for 50 days. Well, 50 now. Hasn't been 50 yet. It's 50 days before the election. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Number one, it's a candidate protection plan, like I've said all the time. And number two, they can judge where these votes are coming in from, and it allows parties, mainly Democrats in these really early voting states, to adjust their late campaign spending. So again, and it does not. There are no long-term proven studies that say it drastically increases voter turnout. So please don't buy that. Pete in Milford's with us this afternoon to lead us off. Peter, hello, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Good.
First of all, yeah, that is not acceptable. 50 days. I mean, I'm not even a big fan of, sending in your votes through the mail. I think unless you can physically can't go out there or get there, you should have a note from the doctor. And then, okay, I get that. What's the matter with going out, going down there, if you really care, and signing your vote and placing it? There's too many variables in what you were talking about, and variables create the possibility of corruption.
Yeah, and you know, Pete, though, we are only one of four states, believe it or not, Pete, 46 states have some form of early voting. I'm not completely against early voting, but 30 days, 40 days, 50 days, no. And some knucklehead in Hartford is sure to suggest that. Pete, I'm saying this. If an election day is on a Tuesday, obviously, okay. The Wednesday before, the Thursday before, maybe, even the day before the election on a Monday. You know, there's some people, Pete, that just want to go to the polls, but they're infirmed a little bit or they can't stand around. And I guess, Pete, part of the problem is, too, these municipalities, I mean, you got to crowbar them to get them to add a polling place, you know, to eliminate the lines.
I get that. Yeah. I get that. No.
Yeah, all so, right, Pete, Paul, yeah, thank you, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
One more thing.
Yeah.
Paul.
Yeah.
Listen, on Sunday, yeah. I wish that you guys were on longer, both the Italian House Party and your hour. Maybe you could talk to the bosses and maybe loop the show, you know, on tape longer, because the sauce needs longer time to cook, and it cooks better during that music.
Yeah, there's something about that. Scientists have been trying to figure that out for years. Why does the sauce? Thank you, Pete. Appreciate the call. Thank yes. Why does the sauce taste better with Frank Sinatra and Domenico Modugno playing in the background? I don't know. They still haven't figured that out. There is a fascinating story unfolding overseas. We've heard over the past couple of weeks the relatively short tenure of Liz Truss, who was a rather short-lived woman to hold the prime minister's position in Great Britain, a staunch U.S. ally. She resigned. There were rumblings that Boris Johnson was going to come back, but Rishi Sunak is the new prime minister of Great Britain, and he is quite a story, and a lot of people are saying that this move would maybe have been, and I agree, would have been unthought of, or just you would have been laughed out of the room 15, 20 years ago if you said to someone, with all due respect, that an upcoming British prime minister would be of Indian ancestry and practiced Hinduism. Joining us right now to talk about that is a professor of international business at Quinnipiac University. He is a Fulbright professor, or was, in Jordan in 2018. He's taught in several countries, including Bangladesh, China, France, Egypt, and Mexico. Dr. Mohammed Elahi joins us. Dr. Elahi, hi, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
Well, thank you, Professor, for taking the time. We appreciate it. And boy, am I off base here? Do you think I'm not saying that 15, 20 years ago, if someone had said to you, hey, the next prime minister of England is a person of Indian descent and is practicing Hinduism, I think a lot of people would have looked at me a little odd. But what are your thoughts on this?
I think even 10 years ago, nobody could have fathomed that somebody of Indian origin would become the prime minister of the UK. It is really an amazing development, but it also shows how much the country has changed, how much more inclusive, how much more multicultural UK has become over the years.
And when you consider that, you know, you had the facts of Great Britain's colonialism and the UK's colonialism over the years, I was thinking about this morning, prepping for our interview. It really makes it, on that level, Dr. Elahi, even more fantastic.
I cannot agree more with you. England has this long history of colonization. People who immigrated from the colonies, they were never really considered equal to the rest of the British people. They were always like second-class citizens. There were a lot of racism, discrimination. But we have to give credit to the people of England, or I should rather say UK, because they have overcome all those racial prejudices and they have basically shattered all the barriers, ethnic barrier, racial barrier, religious barrier. And Rishi Sunak is also the youngest prime minister in 200 years. And his parents actually were part of the Indian diaspora in East Africa. So he also has some East African connections, and of course through his wife, more connections with India. But this is really a watershed moment in the history of the UK.
And that people in Southport, Westport, Fairfield, anywhere around Connecticut, with the connections to the UK, to Great Britain, and or connections to India, or maybe practitioners of the Hindu faith, must be looking with awe at the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, Rishi Sunak, who takes over from Liz Truss, who was there for about 10 minutes, and now she is gone. And Dr. Mohammed Alahi joins us once again, Professor of International Business at Quinnipiac University. Professor, he's a finance guy, Sunak, from what I'm reading, right? He has a deeply complex and involved resume in finance. He and his wife, you mentioned his wife before, very rich people, an estimated net worth I see here of almost $750 million pounds in Great Britain, in the UK. So how will this help him? Because he is entering a rather tricky situation in Great Britain and the UK, is he not?
He is, in fact, on a tricky spot, but I think he will be able to handle it better than his predecessors. He and his wife both attended Stanford University. He obtained his MBA from one of the best universities in the world. And then he worked for Goldman Sachs. So he is intimately familiar with global finance. And as you know, the British economy, it relies more on financial services than manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, he's the right person who can actually calm the markets, steady the economy. And he is known as a technocrat. He is going to bring the sanity and order in 10 Downing Street, which was sadly missing for the last few years. So I am very optimistic about the positive role that he can play.
When you, doctor, when you use the word technocrat, explain that. I mean, we've all heard that. We know what it is. But your characterization of him, how do you term technocrat with him, and how will that help the UK and the British people?
Sure. So in many ways, he's not a typical politician. If you look at his resume as a politician, it's pretty thin. He got elected only in 2015 when he was pretty young. But he came with experience in the financial sector. He worked as the assistant treasury secretary. He became the chancellor of the exchequer, which is equivalent to the treasury secretary in the USA. And he is conservative, but he is the old style. He follows the old style conservatism. So his policies are sound. Actually, I like most of his policies except one. He was in favor of Brexit. That I do not understand why he supported that. But other than his stand on Brexit, I think he understands the macroeconomics. He understands how all the global markets are interconnected. And if we look at what actually led him to come to the power, the mistakes that Liz Truss made, she, or I should rather say her government, enacted some major tax cuts. They proposed even before actually they became law. They thought that their policies will be considered market friendly, but market really reacted negatively and the market was brutal. And it is the market forces that ousted Liz Truss. Mm-hmm. And I think Rishi Sunak, he understands the macroeconomics, he understands the global politics, and he would take measures that would actually allow the British economy to recover from all the self-inflicted wound. And frankly speaking, I think he may also be able to chart a new course after Brexit. Mm-hmm. This whole Brexit created a big mess for the UK. I think UK could not really come out of the mess that it created by leaving Brexit. So now it's time for starting a new chapter, and he may just be the person who can actually lead the UK to a new direction.
Why do you think that he was for Brexit then? Because, yeah, I did read some stuff early today, Doctor, before our interview, and that seems to be the one thing that sticks out that a lot of people say, hey, we don't get this. Why, with his experience, why do you think he was for that?
Actually, I think that at that time, Rishi Sunak and other conservative politicians in England, they were using the threat of Brexit as a bargaining chip. They wanted to extract more concession from the EU, and they never really thought that people would actually vote for Brexit. It was a big gamble that they played, and they lost the gamble. I think they did not expect people to vote for Brexit, and it was just a very thin majority that voted for Brexit. But once people voted for Brexit, they did not have any way to basically come out of that mess. They did not have any exit plan from that mess.
Why do you think, on the subject of the tax cuts that Liz Truss wanted to put through, why did that make the market so turbulent there and then lay the avenue for Prime Minister Sunak now to take power? I mean, a lot of people here in the U.S., they love tax cuts. They always say, well, hey, more money that people can keep and they can spend. What's the difference over there?
I think you raised a very good point, and I'm afraid that U.S. politicians would not take lesson from the U.K. because too much tax cut is not good, because if we have tax cut but we still have to pay for all the expenses, and government over the years, they have gotten bigger in every single Western country. So how are we going to fund all the government expenditures? And many American politicians who just want to cut tax, they think that tax cut would lead to higher revenue. That does not really happen. The invisible hand of free market does not always help. Sometimes that invisible hand also needs hand-holding by the government hand. And that is why too much tax cut is really bad for the economic health of a country. If you look at the U.S., if you look at the 1990s, that was in the recent past one of the most, I would say, productive years for the USA. At that time, our monetary policy combined with our fiscal policy helped propel the U.S. economy. And that is when American prosperity returned. Since 1960s, we did not really see that much prosperity. And people across the board actually were able to achieve higher living of standard in the 1990s. And at that time, tax rate was much higher than what it is today. So I think, and I hope that American politicians, they would take lesson from this and try to be fiscally more responsible.
And, Doctor, finally, back to the Prime Minister himself. Is there a fear that there's going to be more of, a microscopic look on him? He'll be under more scrutiny simply because of his lineage and because he's not a white Anglo in the office now? Is he likely going to get, as humans are tend to do when somebody looks different or acts different, is that going to be a problem for him or maybe not? What do you think?
I'm afraid that once the initial euphoria is over, people would be raising questions about his ethnicity, about the domicile status of his wife. And in many ways, UK might go through what USA had gone through when Obama became president. Initially, everybody was very happy. There was high expectations that USA has reached a post-racial society. But that did not happen. We actually witnessed more racism, more questions about Obama's ancestry. And I'm afraid that we might witness the same in the UK. And within a few days after the initial honeymoon period is over, a series of challenges will present themselves to Rishi Sunak. The energy crisis that with winter coming, I think that will be a big problem. The energy price has been going up and nobody knows which direction the Russia-Ukraine war will be going. People do not want to pay higher energy bills. Many UK workers, government workers, they are threatening to go on strike.
Yeah.
So that can paralyze the economy. The National Health Services of the UK, that seems to be in a perennial hole. So all these problems, when they hit him, and unfortunately they will all hit him at once, how he handles that, that would tell how British people actually accept him and treat him. And when the expectation is very high and leaders cannot deliver on time, all types of problems start. And a lot of problems are actually brewing. But right now, people are not talking about that. But I hope that he will be able to handle and deliver some results quick to dispel all the misgivings.
And we can always, Doctor, watch the Prime Minister's questions, because no matter who the Prime Minister is, that's always one of my favorite things, the unique things about the British government, to see Rishi Sunak or anybody have to field questions in that well of Parliament is always entertaining as well.
That is also one of my favorite programs.
Absolutely. Dr. Mohammed Elahi, he is a professor of international business at Quinnipiac University. Doctor, thank you. We appreciate the time. We'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
No, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks. Dr. Mohammed Elahi joining us right now is a person whose name will be on the ballot. We've had her on before plenty of times as a legislator, once during the race. It's State Rep. Laura Devlin, who is the lieutenant gubernatorial running mate on the ticket with Bob Stefanowski. Laura, Paul again, how are you?
I am really well, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Laura. I'm doing okay. It's round number three of COVID, but I'm actually feeling much better today. So, chug-a-lugging DayQuil works, Laura. It really does.
Definitely.
You know, maybe over ice next time with a twist of lemon. We'll try that next time. So, Laura, listen, the polls have not been great. You know, there are these double-digit polls, but it's interesting. Double-digit lead that is shown for Ned Lamont and Susan Bicewicz, but I've spoken in the past few days to both Ben Proto, the state Republican Party chair, and to Nancy DiNardo, the state Democratic Party chair. They're both not putting too much stock in the polls, and they both told me, Laura, one word, turnout. Do you agree with that on what the key issue will be here?
You know, absolutely. But I think the reality is that this race is very, very close. And it is a winnable race for Republicans to hold the governor's office. Bob and I, the governor clearly knows this, too, because he is spending $1 million a week on radio and TV to not only misrepresent his time in office and accomplishments or lack of, but also to misrepresent the positions of Bob and I. His attack ads, that's not the sign of a winning candidate. So this race is really, really close. And, you know, I'm not that surprised. We've been working hard and people want change. They can't afford to stay here and have real concerns about public safety.
You know, Laura, one thing that bothers me, and I've talked about this on several levels of the campaigns this year, is the tough issues, Laura, in this state. I mean, the real tough issues of our tax burden, our energy costs, of the cost of doing business in this state. You know, for some reason, the majority here in the state and our top politicals, those are things that are never discussed. We talk about, well, tax rebate for this, which is nice, or, you know, getting funding for this, which is nice. Hey, I funded this, with the full funding. Well, thanks for doing your job. But it frustrates me, and you saw it in many years as a legislator, that we don't go after the issues that never seem to go away.
Well, they can't go after those issues because their policies have failed. We have a governor who is out saying, hey, you know, I have cut your taxes. Hey, we have the lowest utility rates in New England. And hey, we've got our mojo back. Like, I don't know what alternate universe he is existing in, but the people that I have been talking to for months, you know, are worried about, can I fill my oil tank? Can I pay for groceries? You know, a double pack of 18 pack of eggs at BJ's Wholesale. This is my best latest example. This summer was about $5. Not long ago, it was about $8. And now it is over $12. Right? I mean, some people have the ability to, you know, go and not be worried about these price increases so much. But there are families who are struggling and it's not being addressed. But
Laura,
we will make Connecticut more affordable.
A few more minutes, though, with the State Rep. Laura Devlin, who is running for lieutenant governor on the Republican ticket with Bob Stefanowski. Laura, are you at all surprised that the
attacks the innuendo, which in some of these ads kind of walks a very fine line. The innuendo of, well, you can't trust Stefanowski and Devlin on abortion, ladies. I mean, every ad is voiced by a female, either actor or voiceover person, and it leads off, Laura, with abortion. Does that surprise you or not? And does that offend you at all?
So, well, I am not surprised by it, Paul, because, again, right, abortion is an incredibly personal, individual, and can be a divisive issue. And despite the fact that both Bob and I have repeatedly stated that we are pro-choice, he will be a pro-choice governor, he will not change the laws of Roe v. Wade in the legislature, and I have a voting record supporting women's reproductive rights. But it goes back to the fact that because it is such an emotional issue, that's all they can talk about, because they can't talk about their policies, their failed policies that have made it less expensive or less affordable to live in the state of Connecticut and less safe. I heard the lieutenant governor state yesterday that despite the police accountability bill, that Connecticut is one of the safest states and violent crime is down. I mean, again, I don't know where these people live, because it is not what the majority of the people in this state are experiencing.
And
not surprised.
Yeah, and Laura, numbers can be moved around, and yes, even though some crime is down, the fact that I have to come on this show on a pretty regular basis and discuss with my listeners something that happened in our area that has to do with a carjacking or an armed robbery of an elderly person in a supermarket lot, and the fact that the majority in Hartford had dragged kicking and screaming into some sort of juvenile crime, juvenile justice reform, a lot of people just don't buy that. I mean, I've been the victim of crime many times, and you don't want to hear numbers. You want concrete answers.
Right. And, that vote that took place this last session happened because this is an election year, and their rhetoric that, crime is down, nobody feels it. Nobody, that's not what people experience. It's not what you hear, and it's not what you feel. And that makes a big difference.
If/when, I know candidates like to say that, but assuming that you and Bob are elected the next governor, lieutenant governor of the state, what would be some of your initial priorities? I know there's a big thing about the first 50 days or 100 days. The media people like me, we all love that kind of stuff because it makes for good copy and good chat. But if Laura Devlin were queen in an ideal Republican world in Hartford, what would be an initial issue or two that you would get right to work on?
So two that we would absolutely get right to work on are making our state more affordable and safer. And we would make our state safer by doing three core things to support our police officers. We would reinstate qualified immunity. We would redefine the standards for use of force. And we would reinstate consent searches. And those three things would have a huge impact in terms of getting guns off the street, and illegal guns, drugs, and overall reduction of crime, enabling our police officers to do their jobs safely and confidently. The other, in terms of affordability, we would make some immediate changes to our tax structure, get our sales tax just under 6% at 599. We would get rid of Governor Lamont's extra 1% tax on food. So if you're rushing and you go grab out of the grocery store that prepared package of meatballs or lasagna or whatever, you're paying more tax on that because of Governor Lamont. We would also suspend all three gas taxes. It's convenient that the 25-cent tax expires just after Election Day, but we would suspend to the end of 23 the gas tax, the diesel tax, and the petroleum gross excise tax. And then we would evaluate, can we do anything further? And I think a significant piece is to address our property taxes, and we have to keep our municipalities whole. So what we have proposed is a SALT deduction where you can deduct up to $10,000 of your property tax off your state income tax. So that would enable, you know, we wouldn't be interfering at all with our local municipalities, but we would be able to provide some relief. There's also changes we would make to support businesses in the state of Connecticut. We would not saddle them with the unemployment compensation fund. That's an extra tax. We would not implement the highway use tax scheduled for January 1st. That will make everything more expensive in our state. Mm-hmm. So there are real common sense proposals that we have that would not jeopardize what the Republicans were able to put in place in the 2017 budget in terms of, you know, spending cap, rainy day fund, pension payments, all of that. It can be done, and we can do it, and we will.
And Laura, final question before we wrap up here. You mentioned consent searches. Now, I explained that to somebody the other day who, granted, was a very smart person, but they're not really into the political side of this. And I explained the change there, and their jaw hit the floor. They said, no. And I said, yes. Explain the controversy in the police bill regarding these consent searches and why it's bad.
So if a car is stopped, right, and there might be multiple people in that car, the officers cannot ask for an identification. I mean, there could be no need for it because everybody could be fine. You could have a wanted felon in the car and not be able to ask for an identification. You cannot ask, can I search this car? And if you talk to any officer, what they will tell you is that that was one of the biggest ways that we were able to get illegal guns off the street and also illegal drugs. And, you know, I shared a story before about talking to a woman in New Haven. Bob and I were both there, and she said she hears gunshots every night. And I said, you know, this is not normal. Do not accept this as normal. But things have absolutely gotten worse, and they've gotten worse because of the police accountability bill that was rushed through by the Democrats in charge. All but one of them voted for it, and it was political, which is not a good way to make public policy.
Laura Devlin. Laura, thanks. Great to chat with you again, and we'll surely chat down the road. Thanks, Laura. Take care and be safe.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. There you go. Laura Devlin, longtime Fairfield state legislator, now running for the lieutenant governor slot on the Republican ticket. Yeah, that consent search thing. You know, folks, that cops are now largely prevented from, if they pull a car over under suspicion, they are very limited on what they can ask or do, because we want to cut down on police. Not we, but, you know, the narrative was, and again, this was all post George Floyd. The far left in this country took a very tragic incident that was perpetrated on a man by a rogue cop in a rogue police department that everybody knew about for years, but it became a lever, a stepping stone for a lot of leftist ideas in police and law enforcement.